finished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening, and welcome to An Adventure in History. I'm Alana Quila with Providence Seaside Hospital, here tonight with Mac Burns, Executive Director of the Clatsop County Historical Society. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. It feels like fall is, like, finally here. I'm not going to say winter, though.
Although, like, a week ago, we had that hail storm all, like, Sunday. Yeah. It was weird.
Yeah.
It was piling up. I almost got a snow shovel out.
That's why I'm not going to say it's winter, because this is like the true fall, right? Mm-hmm. The leaves are coming down. It's getting colder. Got darker also. Yeah.
But I have to give a shout out to the Astoria Fire Department.
Oh, yeah?
Because when I mentioned the hailstorm, I didn't mention last week, but we had an incident at the Flavelle house. It was kind of scary. Our furnace started putting out smoke.
Oh.
And the smoke detectors went off. We had to evacuate the house. Thank goodness it happened during the day. Oh, this has never happened during my time here, so it was very frightening. And all I could think of was burning Fort Clatsop down.
Yeah,
because I don't want that on my watch.
You don't want
it. I mean, I don't want it at all, but I don't want it while I'm the director.
No.
So the Astoria Fire Department showed up very quickly, and the smoke had kind of dissipated by then, but we couldn't figure out where it was coming from because it was coming through the vents. But we didn't know that. All of a sudden, we just noticed this room was filled with smoke, and that room was filled with smoke. No smoke damage. So I don't know that it was like billowing thick, but it was hazy.
You could
tell. No doubt about it.
Wow.
But they like searched the whole house and couldn't find the exact location. They said, call your furnace guy, call an electrician. Yeah, and we shut all power off. And that was on Saturday a week ago. And then Monday morning, furnace guy came and we're like, definitely the motor. No doubt about it. But the Astoria Fire Department calls me back.
Oh.
And they're like, we've been really worried because it's the Flavelle house. And they're like, was it the furnace for sure?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, we're getting a new motor. And so
that's so good.
But the follow-up, and I actually, yeah. I said, would you guys call anybody back or is it just us?
Well, they probably think the likelihood of yours probably burning to the ground is a little higher, maybe because of the age. Some significance there.
Well, it's the balloon structures as well, the balloon construction, because basically there's 2x4s that go all the way from the attic to the basement. It's just like chimneys all the way around.
Oh, my gosh.
When I first moved to town, the fire chief, Leonard Hansen, joking, obviously, but he says, if I ever really get a fire call at your place, I'm just bringing marshmallows and hot dogs. Like, I don't want to hear that from the fire chief.
Yeah, terrible.
And he, like, laughed. He's like, no, come on. But seriously, this would be a problem.
Yeah.
He's like, you really should look at trying to put a sprinkler system in or something.
Noted. So did you?
No, because it's crazy expensive. But, obviously people would say, but the Flavelle is irreplaceable, and it is, but
water damage is bad too, though.
It is, and you got $500,000 to help install and hide a watering system.
Well, if there's any donors out there who would like to install a sprinkler system,
but I love that everything worked.
Yeah, that is
the smoke detectors went off, the fire department rolled, the visitors got out. Although, I have to say, there are 2 fire trucks, the command unit, and the firefighters are all in full regalia coming in and out. And there's staff there because a couple of my staff came in and we're there. And obviously we're on phones and we're looking concerned and we're talking to the volunteer docents. And I actually have not one, not two, but 3 different people not connected to each other say, can we come into the house? And I'm like, no, there's kind of an emergency going on. And all 3 of them say, so in a few minutes.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm like, no, go get a refund. I'm sorry. We're not going to be open the rest of the day. We're closed. Like, what do you need to see? Billowing smoke and flames coming out the windows?
Put on the jacket and then you can go in with the
It was
the
very odd to me.
That's funny.
I mean, it'd be one thing if the firefighters were on their way out and leaving. Like, oh, is it clear? Can we go in now? But they were still there.
It was an active emergency. Well, at least they asked.
So I have another moment, a Seinfeld moment here that I have to ask your opinion on. So you fly into some foreign city in America, not I mean, just like outside of Portland. You're flying somewhere. You've got an airport hotel that you're going to stay in, and you're getting a rental car the next day. So the airport shuttle provided by the hotel, you call, and you're like, hey, Hotel X, I've got a reservation there tonight. Can you send the van over to pick me up? Do you tip that driver?
Yes.
Thank you.
Of course you do.
I got into a debate with a family member. Oh. It was like, really? You tipped? I'm like, it's complimentary. I'm like, okay, but they still came out in the rain. And yeah, it's the guy's job, but.
But they work for tips, just like your waiter, just like, your, you know, your servers and your,
So I was right.
You were right. There you go. Seinfeld moment of no good use to anybody out there.
Yeah, it was a very strange encounter, but we will forego that. So let's get to the big history highlights.
Okay.
These are things that happen tomorrow, of course, November 15th, 1492. Christopher Columbus notes the first recorded reference to tobacco.
Oh, interesting.
Tobacco.
Yeah.
What's it good for? Nothing. Does it have any other uses, really, besides smoking?
I don't know.
It just occurred to me as I was saying that maybe there's like some really great medicinal use for it that I'm not aware of.
You're right. I don't know.
I mean, how many lives has tobacco ruined?
Oh, yes.
In so many ways.
Yes.
Back to this time period where we're going to enslave Native Americans and force them to make tobacco for us. And
and no filters or anything then. Yeah.
I'm going to have to research that. Because maybe I shouldn't be totally down on tobacco. I think I should be. Okay, 1867, first stock ticker debuts. Tick, tick, tick. The first stock ticker is unveiled in New York City. 1867, the advent of the ticker ultimately revolutionized the stock market by making up-to-the-minute prices available to investors around the country. Prior to this development, information from the New York Stock Exchange, which has been around since 1792, traveled by mail or messenger.
That's amazing.
Isn't it?
Yeah. What a system.
Yeah. The ticker was the brainchild of Edward Callahan, who configured a telegraph machine to print stock quotes on streams of paper tape. Genius. The same paper tape used later in ticker tape parades.
Oh,
fun. So it really is ticker tape, at least once upon a time. The ticker, which caught on quickly with investors, got its name from the sound its type wheel made.
Yes, but it has to be annoying.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
If you're in that office all the time.
Somebody must have been like, why did you have to attach a sound to this?
I didn't even thought about that because I like just the idea of like the temporary. But yeah, if it's running all the time.
All the time.
You made me rethink that. 1904, King, not like the king, that's the guy's name, King C. Gillette patents the Gillette razor blade.
Oh, that one stuck around for a while.
Yeah. 1956, Elvis makes his movie debut in Love Me Tender.
Oh, wonderful. Blue Moon's a good one.
See, I don't know that I like him as an actor.
Oh, well.
I'm torn.
He's an entertainer always, right? I mean, even in the movies, that's what he's doing.
Yeah. 1959, not a good one. And I think we've talked about this before. The Clutter family murders outside Holcomb, Kansas, by Richard Dick Hickok and Perry Smith. And, of course, that's Truman Capote's book In Cold Blood. Yeah. And I always promote the original movie. It is pretty good. Soundtrack by Quincy Jones.
Oh.
Let's see. 1969, Wendy's Hamburgers, opened by Dave Thomas. In Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah. See, we have talked about this because we went to the same church.
That's
in
right.
Florida.
I remember that.
It was a mega church.
You said he sat way in the front.
He did. I think it was like the front row because the pastor would refer to him and he's like right there.
You know, we missed our anniversaries because you started the show in September.
You're right.
Yeah. And I didn't bring you flowers or anything.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Man. Well, big celebration next year.
And then the anniversary of the show is in March and we didn't do anything this March either.
Okay. Well, next year.
We're just like an old married couple.
We're still
now.
Recovering. Yeah.
We don't.
Last year didn't happen.
But our history highlight of the day, I think had the most important impact on history. 1777, the Articles of Confederation is adopted.
Have to agree.
Still, okay, it's the worst form of government in the world, except for all the others. Okay. Even with the dysfunction that we see today, it is still the best form of government, I think. And the Constitution, which this is the precursor to.
Right.
It's just an amazing document. I love it.
Spoken like a true white man.
There are issues and there are flaws.
There are.
It's an experiment that's ongoing.
That's true.
And I hope that it doesn't fail as an experiment. I hope it keeps moving forward.
That, yes. Yes.
Now you're making
just
me feel,
pointing out the obvious
you're
here.
You're making me feel guilty.
No.
Did I miss any?
No, you haven't. No, that was good.
Wow, that might be the first.
Oh, that could be.
It could be.
Yeah.
All right. So today, I'm not quite sure the theme of this. This could be river tales.
Or strange stories.
Strange stories from the river, from the water around us. These are just things from the newspapers that were accumulated for our magazine cum tucks.
Nice.
But they were kind of jumping out at me. I was searching for something else and I found these.
And all local. So
all local. Yeah. So and there's no real order to these, but this comes from 1910, April 1st, 1910. No April Fool joke. And I like these because of the writing, of course. The newspapers were just, I love the way they write back then. The best fish story that has happened in these parts for a long time was witnessed on Thursday afternoon by many at the OR&N Wharf. It was the capture of a fine 30-pound Chinook salmon by a man who saw it floundering in the mud after the tide had gone out. It had evidently been caught in one of the holes in the inside wharf, and as the tide receded, was left in the mud. Its captor took the string from his shoe and, slipping it through the gills of the salmon, brought it ashore. Water bailiff Angus Gore was notified of the catch, but he quickly realized that there was no closed fishing season against such a mode of securing salmon. It would indicate, however, that there must be plenty of salmon in the river, for it is rare that one will get onto such shallow water.
That's a good one.
I like that the bailiff's like, wait a minute now, there's a fee or whatever. Yeah. And then, well, but you caught it very strangely.
Shoestring catch. Okay, another one. Fishing with a shotgun. Deep sea fishing with a shotgun is the latest feature at Seaside. It isn't deep sea fishing exactly, for the water is not deep near shore, but the sport comes under that category. Jennings, a Portland taffy candy manufacturer, is working the scheme. A large bore single barrel shotgun is placed in a box nearby where it can reel out rapidly. When the gun is discharged, the sinker is thrown into the ocean, carrying the fish line with it. That comes from the Astoria Daily Budget on August 7th, 1900.
Okay, so the next one is August 11th, 1903. A full load. Stensland N. Johnson, the Sand Island seiner, met with an experience a few days ago that is believed never to have happened before. On one haul of his seine, it was so full of salmon that the weight of the fish ripped a big hole in it and the greater portion of the fish escaped. But the broken seine brought 2 tons of salmon to shore.
Nice.
Can you imagine that much salmon?
Yeah. Wow. June 11th, 1901. A fisherman was seen at Clifton last night with his blankets on his shoulder, headed for the train. When asked why he was leaving so early in the season, he replied he had fished 2 months and a half and had made only $10.50. That experience, he thought, was enough for any man, and he was going to try to make a living some other way than fishing.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah.
A midnight fishing trip. August 1st, 1901. R.F.C. Astbury and Philo Eberman, I love those names, had a thrilling experience at Seaside the other night. They determined to make a moonlight fishing trip up the Nakanakum, but neglected to provide for the moonlight. When darkness set in, it set as only darkness can, and when the fishermen started on their return, it was so dark they could not see. On the way down the stream, the boat was run onto a snag and capsized, the occupants being thrown into the water. They were compelled to abandon the skiff and walk home, a distance of something like 10 miles, arriving at 3 a.m., both were soaking wet and had no fish.
I love that last part.
That'll teach you.
All for nothing. August 10th, 1901, from the Morning Astorian, the Beer Barrel Bonanza. One of the richest catches made in the Columbia River since the first net was stretched in its water was no doubt made yesterday on the seining ground on Wallace Island opposite Clatskanie. Yesterday, when drying a seine, the men at work discovered something in the net that, while not exactly totally strange to them, was something not usually caught in fish nets. It was a half barrel of beer, and it was in good condition. The keg was tenderly carried to camp, and in the evening, a war dance was given in its honor. 15 gallons of beer refreshed the dancers, and the hilarity kept up until the keg gave out from sheer exhaustion. More nets will be stretched in the future, and a sharp lookout will be kept for other kegs.
I love that they use the word hilarity a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I like that word, too. It makes me laugh.
They definitely had fun with that one. I mean, yes.
A new fish, 1915. I didn't know we were still finding new fish. While in search of clams at the ocean beach near Fort Stevens yesterday, soldiers from the post found quite a number of the new species of fish, the discovery of which was mentioned in the budget a few days ago. Noting a slight uneven upheaval in the sands at the edge of the water, one of the soldiers examined it and unearthed a fish weighing about 3/4 of a pound. Their curiosity aroused, they continued the examination of the sand bumps and uncovered 49 fish in less than an hour. The fish are equipped with the usual fins, but lack scales. They have a smooth and rough, rather tough skin. The soldiers fried a number of to test their edible qualities and pronounced them most palatable. A specimen has been forwarded to the State University. As before stated, the first one of these fish ever seen locally was discovered about 3 years ago, but only the one could be found. This year, however, there are scores of them. And apparently, officials from the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Department were unable to identify them from this description, except to suggest that they might be sculpins. Am I saying that right?
I don't know. Sounds like they identified them.
Yeah, 1915.
September 20th, 1902, the Astoria Herald. Smoke got in their eyes. John Johnson of Burnside, who was in the city Thursday, reports a peculiar circumstance, which was probably due to the conditions existing last Friday, when the smoke from the forest fires was so dense, Mr. Johnson is watchman at McGregor's Hunting Preserve near Svensson. There is a little lake on the island where many great wild birds feed. On last Friday, the sky near there was lurid with the reflection of the sun on the dense smoke clouds. The next morning, when Mr. Johnson arose, he was surprised to find the beach surrounding the island literally covered with sardines, which were still alive. He is of the opinion they were attracted by the peculiar color of the sky and made no effort to keep in the water when the tide began to ebb. The air was filled with several varieties of birds, which were having a feast on the little fishes. How interesting.
Yeah, I don't know that I want to see that live.
Yeah.
Kind of creeps me out. Let's see. 1891, a mystery of Cullaby Lake.
Dun, dun, dun.
The catfish moves. The catfish moves and multiplies in a dark, mysterious way. A few years ago, the government fish commissioner stocked some of the lakes of Oregon and Washington with catfish. Now, I had no idea. I'm kind of surprised. And maybe there's still catfish and fishermen will be like, of course there are, Mac.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I don't know what they stock it with. Trout, right?
Yeah, I know, trout. Yeah. After the lapse of a few short seasons, they were found in the Willamette and the Columbia. Now it is reported that Cullaby Lake is full of catfish and that they continue to hatch. And the more they hatch, the more there are to hatch. And where it is all going to stop, no one seems to know. D.F. Stafford, who lives near the lake, has been in the habit of catching whitefish there. But a few days ago, he found that whenever he fished for whitefish, he got nothing but catfish. The great question, which may be forever unanswered, is... how did the catfish get into Cullaby Lake? Did they brave the dangers of the open ocean to reach the mouth of the Nakanicum and thence follow up the Ohana, now known as the Wahana? Or did they go up Skippinon Creek to the head of navigation and from thence travel overland on foot to the lake? But in the meantime, the catfish have got there.
That's a good one. Let's see. From February 27th, 1950, in 1925, an unexplained phenomenon happened. A tide brought in millions of living, minute clams, 1/2 to 1 inch in length, which covered the Warrenton Beach for several days. That was called clam tide.
Clam tide.
But it was just the clams out on the... Yeah,
that's weird. 1876, Mr. C.A. May, assistant keeper at Point Adams Lighthouse, informs us that a great many fur seal are coming up on the coast south of the Columbia River entrance. In some cases, the seal are dead. In other cases, just alive. Some of the furs are good.
A tall tale. This is from the Daily Astorian, April 26, 1889. An Astorian man tells an Oregonian reporter that a fisherman told him that he had heard that a gang of sea lions from Tillamook had picked up some gillnets lost by fishermen and strung them around on some snags out of Clatsop Spit, forming a rude trap, and that they spread themselves around in a huge circle and drive scores of salmon into the trap and eat them at their leisure. They're so smart.
I was going to say, that's a little disturbing if they're that organized and smart.
A gang of sea lions.
So I do love that historically there have been issues with sea lions about, you know, they take a bite out of salmon and just let it die and all wasted fish at this point. And this has been an ongoing thing that people have tried to come up with ways to deal with them. One of my favorites is from like 1950. The guy goes before fish commission and says he wants to throw depth charges into the middle of them. So, but this one I had not seen before, so I like this one too. This is 1900.
Okay.
Fish Commissioner Reed has decided upon a novel plan to exterminate the sea lions that lay around the mouth of the river and feed on the salmon which are coming in to spawn. The sea lions are not as numerous as in former years, but with the decreasing runs of salmon, their effect is more felt. Their breeding ground is on the rocks around Cannon Beach, where they assemble at times in large numbers and could easily be exterminated. but their bodies would float ashore and then decomposing create such a stench as to render living in that part of the country impossible. The sea lions now, after having eaten all the salmon that they can hold, lay out on the sands that have formed on the south side of the jetty, especially about an acre of that, if they have preempted as their own. Mr. Reed has consulted with Mr. Hegrid, in charge of the government work there, and has gained permission to mine this track with dynamite.
Wow.
And when the sea lions have assembled and are basking themselves in the sun, touch it off. The expense of the work will be paid by Mr. McFarlane, manager of the Columbia River Oil and Guano Company, who will take the bodies of the sea lions that are killed. Each of these sea lions is said to produce from 15 to 25 gallons of oil.
Who knew?
They're going to make a giant minefield. And then blow them up.
Right next to the jetty.
It'll be like the whale.
What could go wrong?
The dynamited whale. What could go wrong?
So it says they tried this few years later. Do you want to keep going?
Well, it has been
reported that C. Lowry either killed or drove away all the sea lions from the rocks at Icola. There are now as many as ever, evidently having returned after their scare was over. Strewn along Cannon Beach for several miles, there are a number of dead sea lions whose rotting carcasses make it very unpleasant for summer visitors. Whales on the waterfront. This is April 27th, 1900. A school of fully a dozen large blackfish or whales entered the river today and came up as far as the city front, where they played for about some time before returning to the sea. Beachcomber's treasure.
This comes from us, 1928. Beachcomber's treasure for 14 years, R.E. Brown, has patrolled Sunset Beach. He is not employed by anyone to do so, and some perhaps wondered why he seemed to wander aimlessly. He knew what he was looking for, and his 14 years of patrolling was justly rewarded when he found nearly 8 ounces of rare ambergris. Ambergris. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that. On the beach recently, and I don't really want to discuss what it is.
Yeah.
So you can look it up. R.E. Garner was with him the day Mr. Brown made his find. Mr. Garner found some 62 ounces of ambergris himself. The two wanted to make sure the substance was ambergris before they attempted to sell it, so they sent some south to be analyzed. Brown and Garner next faced the problem of finding a market for it. While it is exceedingly rare and valuable at the same time, the demand for it is not so great, as only makers of the finest perfumes find need of it. It is now reported that the two have found someone who will buy their supply, and it is thought that they will be paid from $70 to $100 an ounce for it. This is in 1928 prices.
Wow.
This rare substance has been found on the beaches here before. One man in Warrington is said to have a fortune in it, but due to his inability to find a market, is leading a life of poverty. It is lighter than water, gray, marbled, and blackish in color, opaque and waxy in consistency, softens readily under heat, and develops on exposure to the air a sweet earthly odor. It is soluble in oils, but resists acids and dissolves readily in hot alcohol, yielding a substance called amberian, used for making perfume.
Yeah, interesting. May 29th, 1889, from the Daily Astorian. Yesterday afternoon, Captain Phil Johnson was on his way home from Young's River in his plunger with a cow and a half and calf in his boat when suddenly the sail jibed. Sorry, boaters, necessitating the captain to leave the tiller to fix the sail. By some means, the rudder came unshipped and the plunger plunged into the Main Street dock, throwing the captain from the bow to the stern and half filling the boat with water. Captain Johnson was not seriously hurt, but considers it a very narrow escape. Well, what about his cow?
Yeah, nobody cares about the cow.
The calf.
That's terrible. 1922, apparently we invented water skiing.
Ooh.
Perhaps. Rasmus Axi narrowly escaped death Sunday afternoon when he was knocked into the river while bringing a cow, again with the cows in boats, from Skamakaway to his home in George Cashel's launch. While going under a low bridge near Skamakaway, Mr. Cashel gave the engine full speed ahead, which frightened the cow, and as Mr. Axi stood near her to keep her steady, she made a sudden, unlooked-for move, which sent Mr. Axi into the water. Or was it on purpose?
Yeah.
I think maybe the cow was trying to kill him. He managed to get hold of a big rope, which was fastened to the boat, and by hanging on with all his strength, he was able to save himself. He was held under the water for several seconds by the heavy suction of the water. It would have been almost certain death for him if it had not been for his two children, Peter and Marie, who accompanied him on the trip. So when they saw him go over, they screamed at Mr. Cashel to stop the engine. And even then, it was almost a minute or more before they got the boat stopped. And as soon as Mr. Axie was located, he was taken aboard. His arm and hand were severely bruised where he had clung to the hard rope, but he was otherwise unhurt. The rope that was all that saved him from being killed, and he might have been anyway had not the children been there, as Mr. Cashel was in the engine house at the time and perhaps would not have missed him for some time.
I like the rope got first credit and yes. then the children.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure it's the kids. Pretty sure.
But who knew? Cows were moved in boats so often.
Yeah. What could go wrong? December 28th, 1884. This is from the Daily Astorian. The Shubrick, a coast survey vessel, started to lay some buoys in the stream yesterday afternoon, and while at the Tongue Point Depot, Captain J.A. Brown, who was assisting, caught a sight of what seemed to be a man hemmed in between two cakes of ice that came drifting around the point. Officer Richardson and two of the crew put off in a boat to rescue, and getting alongside, found that it was indeed a man who had started to cross the river in a boat some distance above and getting jammed between two ice floes that held together, being carried out to sea. The rescuing party made their way into the ice a little ways and then, throwing him a line, dragged the man and boat from a perilous position into open water. By this time, the whole party had drifted down opposite Flavelle's dock, about 10th in Astoria. The steamer following them down and picking up rescuers were rescued. It was a close call for the individual in the boat, whose name could not be learned.
Hmm.
You got all those other details, but you couldn't get his
name. Terrible reporting. 1887, an awkward position. One of Sam Elmore's fishermen at Tillamook got excited the other day when he heard the fish were 4 cents a pound on the Columbia and started for Astoria. He came to the beach around for, if one times it right, he can avoid a serious climb by slipping along the shore between tides. Coming along in light marching order, just under the high jutting rock that corners into the sea by False Tillamook, he smashed into the water knee deep and came plump on the bear that was feasting on a calf that had fallen from the perpendicular cliff. What's the deal with all these cows?
I know.
Had fallen from the perpendicular cliff above. The man looked at the bear square in front of him, the straight up and down wall of rock on the right, the surging ocean on the left, and his hair raised in fright. Fortunately, Bruin was gorged and good-natured and waddled off after the bear. He's calling the Bruin. That's funny. After a few growls, as having been disturbed to the great relief of the narrator, who had no weapon about him except a small stick, and who says that he now knows what it is to be between the devil and the deep sea with a big black bear in between.
That's a good one. This is 1887. Captain J.G. Hustler and his wife, M.L. Freeland, and wife opposite... let's see, I don't understand this.
Charles Chagrin.
Yes, the place. They were on the beach in a wagon last Tuesday, and they got into quicksand. They hastily unhitched the horses, abandoned the wagon, and got to solid footing. And that is from, again, October 1st,
1887. So 1900. We forget that Astoria was built on pilings, much of it over the water. So Mrs. Hansen of the Astor House met with an accident yesterday afternoon from which she was fortunate to escape without serious injury. She went from the kitchen of the hotel to the woodshed in the rear for an armful of wood. As she was returning, the floor gave away under her and she dropped to the beach below a distance of 25 feet. The tide was out at the time and she sank into the mud nearly up to her waist. She was extricated from her position with difficulty and it was believed at the time that she had been seriously injured, but her only bruise was a slight one on the arm.
Wow. Yeah.
And the Astor House was located on the south side of Duane Street near 11th, today at least.
Yeah. September 22nd, 1915, this is from the Astoria Daily Budget. F.W. Walters, foreman at the Port of Astoria Docks, accomplished a feat Monday afternoon that is considered marvelous. He dove into the water a distance of approximately 35 feet and made a line fast to a counterbalance weight that was lost overboard some time ago, which made it possible to recover the property without any further effort. Walters tried to perform the same trick a few weeks ago, but in each attempt, he failed to reach sufficient depth to gain his object. The pressure of the water at 30 or more feet below the surface is very heavy. Walters was unable to hear any sound for several hours after coming to the surface. However, his determination to succeed won out Monday, and he is likewise happy.
I love that.
So ear damage, but happy.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, take happy over ears anytime.
There we go.
So thanks for those. That was fun. Go make some history, and we'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.